This episode is brought to you by our friends and sponsors, Ricky and Kelly from Groenfell Meadery in Vermont. Ricky says Groenfell is welcoming back Chaos Sizer. He says it was one of Groenfell's first meads, and they stopped making it for a while. Then Groenfell did a one-off, and there was so much excitement, they're welcoming back Chaos Sizer back into the fold. It's launching this weekend, and Ricky says the relaunch was partially inspired by my Brewing It for Basic Brewing video. How cool is that? See how you can get delicious Groenfell and Havoc meads, and now Sizer, as of this weekend, delivered to you at family-owned and operated Groenfell.com. That's Groenfell. Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, February 4th. 2021. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. This week, Casey Helwig from Imperial Organic Yeast joins us to talk about three standard wort tests they advise their clients to do to get the best out of their beers. If you go to basicbrewing.com, you can find archives of our audio and video shows. And if you go to basicbrewingshop.com, you can find our DVDs and our brewer's logbooks. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Basic Brewing and find our show page on Facebook as well. If you want to support us financially, check out patreon.com/basicbrewing. And thanks to everybody who's helping out in that way. If you go to patreon.com/basicbrewing, you can see a long list of stuff that you can access if you sign up as a supporter. This Friday, financial supporters will be getting the first look at the second of the four video episodes that Steve and I shot the other day. I'm posting these out of order. It was actually this third episode that we shot that evening. This one is a Steve beer. He's calling it Cherry Pie Tart Ale. It was several months in the making, brewed with 3 quarts of tart cherry juice and a delicious malt backbone to pair with that. Mmm! He used Imperial Sour Batch Kids. Now, Steve is fairly new to the sour or tart beer game, but he hit this one out of the park. It was really good. I don't want to spoil too much before the episode release, but I wish I had more of that than the couple of bottles that he shared with me. Maybe I can facilitate a trade. Again, financial supporters will see that this Friday, and the general public will see it next week. And many thanks to everybody who's helping out to support the show. Let's jump right into the mailbag. Neil from a small production brewery somewhere in the world writes in. I didn't ask if I could mention the name of the brewery, so I won't. Neil first wrote in saying, "It appears we have a problem with bottling our beer. I suspect the problem lies in a new capper. My main question is there a way to test a glass bottle if it has held the carbonation correctly without actually cracking open the beer? Also, if you could chime in on the potential sources of this problem, insufficient gas in some bottles. I've listed possible concerns," Neil says. "Problematic caps, inconsistent pressure on the capper." This is a hand-closed capper, a very small operation. "Insufficient bottling sugars, weak or tired yeast. Other ideas?" Well, I wrote back to Neil before I realized that he was at a commercial brewery. And I said, years ago, a listener asked a similar question. There was a simple test that somebody else wrote in to shed some light on the situation. When you bottle your next batch and you're bottle conditioning, you're adding priming sugar, after capping, attach a balloon or other rubber-based inflatable device to the top of the bottle. And if the balloon or whatever else you put on there inflates as the bottle conditions, you've got leaky caps. And if not, there are some things that may be suspect in your process. As Neil mentioned, quote-unquote tired yeast, probably unlikely unless it's a very high-gravity beer. So high alcohol in the beer that's beyond the yeast's tolerance, you know, in other words, not necessarily tired, but just, you know, the yeast giving out because there's too much alcohol. Low temperature where the bottles are conditioning, which I've run into. Insufficient priming sugar. Lack of transfer of yeast when you when you're bottling the beer. In other words, if you ferment with a highly flocculent yeast, there may not be enough yeast in solution to carbonate the beer. That's happened to me as well. And not enough time. And frankly, it's the last bullet point there, that not enough time to carbonate fully, that I blame most of my low carbonation beers on numerous times. I've not been patient enough to let my beer condition, especially in the cooler months where the little bathroom that I use to condition my beers, you know, it's a little cooler. Now, there are tools that commercial breweries use to measure carbonation in the bottle, but I believe that involves puncturing the cap, which is essentially, you know, opening it. So Neil replied, Neil says, after I wrote a few queries, we decided to make good use of our samples that we tuck away for quality assurance to examine any differences between bottles from the beginning of the bottling, middle, and end. Neil says, indeed, there was a noticeable difference. We are not getting sufficient dispersion of our bottling sugars. We do not use a secondary vessel to mix the sugars, but rather throw the sugar into the 100-liter fermenter and until now have waited 20 to 30 minutes. Mm-hmm. Neil says, in addition to adding a bit more bottling sugar, we've decided to use more water when diluting the sugar to get a better dispersion and wait a longer amount of time. One theory says the sugars will settle, but I think if the dilution is good, it should stay well dispersed. What do you think? Well, I wrote back that I don't know how long it would take for the sugar water to disperse on its own without agitation. I would imagine temperature and density might play a part in the whole thing. For example, if the sugar water is warmer than the beer, would it tend to stratify toward the top? I don't know. Or if it's colder and more dense, would it settle to the bottom? I'm a firm believer in stirring the priming sugar. However, I realize, you know, if you're racking to another vessel does involve more time and equipment and steps and possible exposure to oxygen. So I'm assuming that Neil isn't in a position to take the yeast out from under the beer with a conical fermenter, maybe. I don't know the situation there. For bottle conditioning, you out there listening, do you batch prime in the fermenter without stirring? If so, what's your secret to making sure the whole batch is primed evenly? Like I say, I'm a big believer in the stirring to make sure that it's all dispersed evenly in there. Drop me an email if you have the secret to bottle conditioning, you know, priming a beer for bottle conditioning in the fermenter without stirring. I don't know. Is it possible? Speaking of email, I've sent out all the Disaster Show prizes except for three. I emailed participants a little while back asking for mailing addresses, and I guess my email is stuck in three of those junk mailboxes. So, Jorge, Greg, and Tom, check your junk mailbox and send me your mailing address so that I can send out your goodie box. It's nothing big or fancy, just a small token of gratitude for the stories. And send it from the email address that you sent in your original letter, you know, so I can check. It's been a while since we've talked about the Build Your Own Beer page from our friends and sponsors Desiree and Dave from High Gravity in Tulsa. On highgravitybrew.com, you can not only find a wide selection of electric brewing systems to fit your needs, you can also order from an incredible selection of high-quality beer ingredients. Using the Build Your Own Beer page on highgravitybrew.com is a lot of fun. It's the whole inventory of a well-stocked homebrew store all on one page. And as you scroll down, you can choose from a wide range of base malts, specialty grains, extracts, hops, yeasts, both liquid and dry yeasts, adjuncts, flavorings, whatever you need. HighGravityBrew.com's Build Your Own Beer page has it all. And your order's total updates at the bottom of the window so that you can see it the whole time that you're scrolling down that that big, long page. HighGravityBrew.com takes the pain out of propane with excellent electric brewing systems, and the Build Your Own Beer page on HighGravityBrew.com makes shopping for ingredients easy and fun. Check it all out at family-owned and operated High Gravity Brew. highgravitybrew.com. That's highgravitybrew.com. Okay, part of being a good brewer is having control of your process and, you know, really knowing what's going on with your beer. And sometimes that means doing some testing. Casey from Imperial talks to us this week about how to do some of those tests on our wort at home. Casey Helwig, welcome back to Basic Brewing Radio.
Thanks so much for having me. Good morning.
It's so good to hear your voice. It's been a long time since we've been able to talk and get together.
Yeah. It's, you know, hopefully soon we'll be able to do it in person and share a pint and think about this real weird time somewhat fondly, not fondly, you know.
But at least in the rearview mirror, you know.
Exactly.
Well, let's talk about the future. I mean, y'all have been mentioning it on the podcast, but you had a really exciting announcement recently where you opened up a new facility to service the East Coast. Talk about that.
Yeah. So in mid-December, we were able to officially open our doors out in Philadelphia. And it feels really good. It's been a project we've been working on for a long time. We secured that location back in November 2019. And then, you know, early 2020, we experienced some delays with just permitting, and then COVID hit. And so here we are almost a year after we were expecting to open up our doors. You know, it's going really, really well. We've had a lot of really great feedback from customers and from, you know, potential breweries that we don't work with. They're super excited that we're out there on the East Coast. Can be considered a local lab, save them some money on shipping. So right now we're just sending our 4 guaranteed in stock strains out of Philadelphia. And we are working on build out right now, production and lab space. It's going really, really well. And we're expecting to have full production capability by the middle of this year.
Wow.
So that'll be our full core strain lineup and homebrew packs.
Wow. So is it a similar setup to what you've got in Portland already?
It is. So it's a slightly smaller brew house. We have a 30-barrel brew house here in Portland, and it's a 20-barrel out there in Philadelphia. But pretty much a mirror in regards to fermentation and lab and shipping department and pouching department and all the rest.
So you've got a location in Portland. You've got a location in Philadelphia. Are you only going to expand into cities that start with P?
I mean, what can we say? We like the letter P.
You don't have to change the monogram on the towels.
Exactly.
No, well, that's excellent. I'm excited for you guys. Back when I first interviewed y'all on the podcast, I think that Owen said that I said, "What are your goals for the company?" I think Owen said, "You know, to be the biggest." And I think I'm embarrassed. I think I laughed because I thought he was joking.
No, he does not joke about things like that.
Well, we're here to talk about, here I am talking to somebody who works for an awesome yeast company, and we're here to talk about tests for wort. Casey, why should we be talking to you about wort testing?
Yeah, I mean, you know, yeast is responsible for fermentation, and you don't get beer without wort, and yeast is kind of the bridge between the two. We get a lot of questions from folks, home brewers, pro brewers, you know, and anywhere in between about troubleshooting fermentations. And often that starts with your wort, you know, what it's comprised of, how clean it is, how stable it is, how fermentable it is. And so we've kind of developed these SOPs to help folks figure out, how to streamline fermentation, how to troubleshoot it, how to make better beer.
So, talking about wort, you, if I remember correctly from a virtual tour that Owen gave, I think for maybe Homebrew Con online, y'all use organic malt extract for your worts, right?
Yep.
Why not make your wort from scratch?
Yeah, so if you're ever at our facility, once the pandemic is over, we would love to have you. And that goes for all you listeners out there as well. One of the big differences between us and a brewery in terms of equipment is brew house. So rather than a 3 or a 4 vessel brew house, we have a 1 vessel brew house. It's just a giant pressure cooker. And so organic DME, dry malt extract, we use that specifically to cut down on the chance for infection. So if we were processing malt and using malt to make our wort or our supernatant, our growth media, whatever you want to call it, grain out and having grain just sitting around hanging out until a farmer comes to pick it up or we can process it or whatever, that's a big potential infection source for our lab. And so, if you've ever let your grain sit out for a couple of days and you kind of walk by it and you get that real strong, like yogurty aroma coming off of it, that's Lactobacillus growing. And so we want to, obviously eliminate any potential infection sources. And then B, it's just a pain. DME is so much easier to deal with. And because we don't care about the flavor or the aroma or the malt backbone of our growth media, it's easier just to use a highly processed DME.
And malt dust, grain dust in the air, has got to be
Right.
a threat to that kind of a thing. If you've got to mill your own grain and all that dust gets in the air, all there's another source of potential infection or contamination as well.
Exactly. Yeah, and if you do ever visit our lab, you'll see that even in the production space that is, looks just like a brewery and operates just like a brewery, people are wearing masks and hairnets. When we walk through, we've got little boot protectors. So we keep it as sterile as possible. And so yeah, grain dust or used grain would be a big potential contamination source.
And your wort has to be sterile. I mean, in home brewing, we say, you boil the wort to sterilize it, or some people say that. It's not really sterilizing the wort, it's sanitizing the wort. And there's a big, big difference in there.
Yeah, sure. So like I said, we have a 1 vessel brew house. It's basically just a giant pressure cooker. And we cook really hot, so upwards of 240 degrees Fahrenheit, and we cook under about 10 pounds of pressure. So we're creating as sterile a wort as possible. And then we plate that wort daily to make sure that, nothing's growing in it.
Which kind of leads us into our first test, the wort stability test. What is this a test of?
So it's basically a test to determine whether your cleaning and sanitation practices are sufficient.
And how likely, I mean, I'm a home brewer and sometimes I mill my own grain in the kitchen. Next to the next near the brew pot, and I have dogs walking in and out of the house, and they're covered in dust, and we may have a fan going on in the kitchen in the summertime. There's a lot of stuff going on. even careful home brewers how likely is it that they can get a truly, you know, 100% stable wort, and what is the margin of acceptability in brewing?
Yeah, I think that, you know, you can get a fairly stable wort as a home brewer, even if you've got dogs and fans and, you know, you're milling grain in the same place that you're brewing beer. And so the wort stability test really is just, you grab a sample, you know, using as sterile and aseptic technique as possible of your wort after it's been cooled, after it's been chilled, but prior to pitching yeast. So typically you snag a sample on the way to the fermenter, and that sample goes into a sanitized or aseptic container. And really what you're doing is just, you know, covering it loosely with some foil and putting it in a nice warm place and just letting it hang out. And you want to see, you know, a stable wort for about 2 to 3 days. And so stable means in this instance, you know, obviously no fermentation happening, so no bubbling, no CO2 being created. You're looking for, you know, turbidity or even some, you know, off aromas. And I think that if you can keep your wort stable for 2 days, you're doing a great job. That means that your cleaning and your sanitation practices are up to par. After that, yeah, you know, you're probably going to see something start to happen with that wort, and that's perfectly acceptable.
Now, looking at your technical document, your standard operating procedure, it refers to a whorl pack. Now, is that something that, say, professional brewers would use to do this test?
Yep. So this is a SOP intended for a pro. Whirl a pack is something you can just buy from BSG. But you can do this at home, you know, using a sanitized and sterilized mason jar or a flask or, you know, whatever container that you can clean and sanitize.
So it's not only a test of your wort itself, it's a test of how sanitized or sterilized you can get the vessel that you're going to be putting the the wort into.
The vessel, you know, your equipment, specifically a heat exchanger. You know, if you're using a chiller that runs wort through it, your potential to have something, kind of some nasty little bug decide to hole up in that heat exchanger is pretty high.
Mm-hmm.
Even with great cleaning and sanitation practices. So
is a lot of what you do trying to help brewers track down where the contamination happens? I mean, once you get a wort stability test and it comes out not clean, you know, after like a day, if you see activity in that wort that is supposed to be stable, what's the first steps? I mean, how do we walk backwards and try to figure out, you know, what went wrong?
Totally. You know, a lot of brewers make this part of their standard practice, you know, wort stability test on every single fermentation. And often the heat X is the culprit. You know, like I said, you've got beer running through the heat exchanger, and there's a lot of little nooks and crannies, and if you're not pumping cleaning solution and sanitizer through that under sufficient pressure, you may run the risk of letting a little bug decide to make a home there.
Mm. And what's the tolerance? I mean, you know, say I'm a typical home brewer. Mm-hmm. You know, and there's going to be, I'm just assuming that my wort is going to be contaminated in some way or another. If you're pitching a healthy amount of yeast, say, oh, you know, 200 billion cells, just as a random number picked out of the air, and you're getting a good fermentation quickly, are you still going to be okay? I mean, what's the margin of error, say, especially for home brewers?
No, absolutely. That's why you want, that's why pitch rate's so important. You want that short lag time. You want the yeast to replicate and to get fermentation rolling as soon as possible, so that if you've got, some contaminated wort, whether that's wild yeast or bacteria or whatever, your yeast outcompetes it. And you're off to a good solid fermentation, and that little wild yeast or bacteria doesn't have a chance to make a sufficient population in your wort
The yeast
and
is
ruin your process.
the good yeast is going to create an environment fairly quickly that is inhospitable to the others.
Exactly. Pitch rate is something that you'll hear Imperial hark on and on about, and it's not because 200 billion cells is an arbitrary number that we grabbed out of thin air. It's because it's a proper pitch rate for standard gravity 5 gallon batches.
My stir plate is dusty because I don't use it anymore. My catchphrase. And I also say that, if I pitch in the afternoon, my airlocks are usually bubbling before bedtime.
Totally.
It is comforting not to have a, and you know, I don't, this isn't meant to be a, 30-minute commercial for Imperial, but it is whatever yeast you use. Doing a starter or, making sure that you have the proper amount of healthy yeast, it really is comforting to see the fermentation happen in a fairly short period of time. It doesn't have to be, like 2 hours, but if it's a Kveik strain, it might. but it is a, that comfort level that the yeast is happy, the yeast is doing its job, and it's doing its job to kind of keep whatever bad bugs are in there under control.
Yeah, you've invested a lot of, money in terms of equipment and ingredients, and then a lot of time making beer. Think about average brew day is about 6 to 8 hours long. You don't want to just pitch your yeast and cross your fingers.
Like I used to. Let's take a quick break from talking about Imperial to talk about Imperial. Casey wanted me to remind you that WO4 Paramount is the seasonal strain available until the end of this month. It's perfect for clean and delicious hard seltzers. Paramount is a very clean and aggressive fermenting yeast combined with the correct amount of nutrients. You got to take care of that. This strain will produce an excellent seltzer with low fusel levels. Paramount is produced on gluten-free media, so you can make truly gluten-free hard seltzers. You've heard on this show that making hard seltzers can be tricky. You need to take care of your fermentations, and of course, that starts with the right yeast. WO4 Paramount will be available until the end of February. Ask your local homebrew store about Imperial Organic Yeast, WO4 Paramount, and check out imperialyeast.com. That's imperialyeast.com. Now, the second test is the VDK qualitative test. What's that?
So are you familiar with diacetyl?
Yes. I'm fairly sensitive to diacetyl, I've found out.
Me too. Oh my goodness! Sometimes I wish I wasn't.
It's I like it. When I'm going to the movies and I have a buttered popcorn.
Yeah, that's delicious diacetyl.
But I don't like butterscotch or butter smells or flavors in my beer, and that's what diacetyl brings to the party.
Right, right. So VDKs or vicinal diketones are the precursor to diacetyl.
So how do we see if we've got them? What's this test all about?
Sure. So every single fermentation is going to produce VDKs. Some strains produce them in higher quantities than others. And that's why at the end of your fermentation, you run a diacetyl rest, which, brings your fermentation temperature up, 2 to 3 degrees Fahrenheit, lets that run for 3 or 4 days. And then you crush your beer and you run it over to your tank to package. This test specifically is a force test. So you're using heat to force the conversion of VDK into diacetyl. Often I recommend that brewers run this at the very end of their diacetyl rest to determine whether or not the yeast has sufficiently cleaned up the VDKs.
So how do we go about it? What are our steps? Walk it to take our hand casing and walk us through this thing.
Yeah, it's super easy. You grab two samples of beer. They don't need to be large samples, 50 to 100 mils is sufficient. I typically use a water bottle or a canning jar, whatever you've got available that you can, cover the sample with. So make sure it's got a lid. And then you keep one at room temperature covered, and you heat the other up to about 150 Fahrenheit while remaining covered. Microwave, water bath, whatever you've got on hand works just fine. And then you chill the heated sample back down to room temperature, and then you just run a simple sensory test. Often I think that it's best if you've got 2 to 3 people involved in this sensory, just so that, if somebody is blind or is having an off day and doesn't pick up on diacetyl, the other two should. And so basically you start with your control sample, so the sample that was not heated. Go ahead, give that, a smell and a taste. You're looking for obvious signs of diacetyl, so that, buttery, butterscotch kind of slickness that you associate with diacetyl. If that sample's clean, move on to your heated sample. And same thing, you're looking for those indications of diacetyl presence. So, again, buttery, butterscotch, that slick mouthfeel. If both samples are clean, you're good to go. Go ahead, crash your beer, and rack it over to package it. If your heated sample is showing signs of diacetyl, continue your diacetyl rest. And then if both samples are, you're definitely, not out of the woods in terms of your fermentation's probably not quite complete, and continue to run your diacetyl rest. So it's a super easy test, and a really great way to just ensure that you're not accidentally giving your friends and family a diacetyl bomb. And I think that your friends and family will thank you for it.
Now, so if you do get do this test and it's in it and it does smell buttery, it does smell butterscotchy, if they're not doing a diacetyl rest, should they warm up their fermentation at that point? Should they rouse their yeast back up to make sure that it's doing the work? Or what are the steps that you
Yeah,
recommend?
definitely. If you're not already doing a diacetyl rest, make sure you can, or do that. Diacetyl rest is pretty simple. You just want to raise the temperature of your fermentation a couple of degrees Fahrenheit, 2 to 3, and let that run for about 3 days, 3 to 4 days.
And I get this question every now and then. Somebody, especially if they're doing like maybe their first lager or something like that, they'll have these horrible sulfury smells coming out of the airlock, and they'll write it right in a panic. My airlock stinks. Is my beer ruined? Is that a good sign or a bad sign or a neutral sign if your airlock stinks?
If you're making a lager, and certain ale strains will definitely produce sulfur, the Hefeweizen strain is coming to mind. That's perfectly normal.
So don't worry about
And
it.
don't worry about it. Let fermentation run its course, and those really aggressive sulfury aromas should clean up over time. That's often why, a nice long lagering period is a good thing. For lager brewers, you are looking for a little bit of sulfur aroma. I think that's a good distinctive part of a well-made lager.
I can't remember what the lager strain it was, but depending on the wort, I mean, if it's I used the same lager strain to brew two different lagers, different malt, but different styles of beer. One smelled like sulfur, the other didn't. I mean, could it be just the ingredients that's encouraging that?
Absolutely.
So don't worry about that.
No, yeah. I mean, even on our side, we'll walk into our production space and we've got, lager strains propping, fermenting, or we've got the GO1 stuff on the Hefeweizen strain propping, and the amount of sulfur that those kick out is pretty unbelievable. And so yeah, it's absolutely a normal part of fermentation, especially with lager strains. And high levels of sulfur is definitely inappropriate, but they tend to clean up and to dissipate through fermentation, and then especially during your lagering phase.
I think as Shrek once wisely said, better out than in.
Exactly.
The third test is the forced fermentation test. So what is the forced fermentation test?
It's pretty much exactly like it sounds. So, you should run a forced fermentation test to determine your true final gravity. And often we recommend that brewers do this when they're making super high gravity beers, or they're making beers that have a lot of adjunct grain in them. And often those things go hand in hand. Thinking like a big, imperial stout. You've got a lot of adjunct grain and you've got a high starting gravity. And so what you're trying to do is determine what your true final gravity is so that you can match your first fermentation with your tank gravity, and you're sure that all of the fermentable sugars in your tank are converted, and you're not going to package something that could potentially be a bottle bomb.
Yeah, I get questions again from listeners. My beer finished at 10:20. 1.020. Is my fermentation stuck? And my question back to them is, well, where did it start? If it started at 10:50, you may have a problem. If it started at like 10:80 or 10:90, you may be okay. And depending on the malt bill, so this is a way that if they test their wort beforehand, they kind of know what to expect.
Yeah, so if you're making a really high gravity beer, or you're making a beer with a lot of adjuncts, this is a super easy test to run. You just grab a sample. We typically recommend about 500 milliliters of your pitched wort on the way to the, from the fermenter, basically. You're going to add more yeast. If you've got liquid slurry on hand, add about 15 milliliters. If you don't, then a half a gram or so of dry yeast is just fine. And then you're going to just cover and incubate it. I try and keep it, relatively warm, 75 to 85 Fahrenheit. Offer it a little bit of oxygen. If you want to keep it on a stir plate, that's fine. Otherwise, just, shake that container every so often as you walk by it. And let the fermentation run its course. Typically, it's going to be finished in about 48 hours. And once you see visible signs of fermentation, stop. Go ahead and check the gravity, and that's going to be your true final gravity. And that is your baseline number. So you want to make sure that your larger batch, your tank gravity, hits that terminal gravity that your forced fermentation did.
So it's just an insurance policy.
Exactly.
You're just trying to overpitch this little sample of wort, and just make sure that the yeast is extremely happy and agitated and oxygenated, and so that they do their job to their full potential. And then once they do, you can get that number that you can compare against your big batch.
I'm
just restating everything you just said, but that's, that's sometimes part of my job.
Absolutely. I don't often make a lot of sense.
No, you made perfect sense.
I think that for a lot of people, if they're running a fermentation and it stops, and it seems like a high number, like 10, 20, people are just like, whoa, is my fermentation stalled? Is it slowing down? And their immediate thought is, oh my gosh, the yeast isn't working. And so we get calls, and yeah, I mean, I'm always happy to walk you through, troubleshoot and figure out what may have gone wrong in your fermentation. But running a forced ferment is a great way to just have a baseline and just offer you a little peace of mind.
So what happens if we do this forced fermentation test in the beginning, and then we ferment our full size batch, and we don't hit that final gravity? What do we do?
Yeah, I would recommend trying to warm up your fermenter a little bit, or gently shake it to just rouse the yeast, get it kind of back up into suspension, and along, both of those things, the temperature being slightly raised and getting the yeast back up into suspension, should help finish out fermentation. If you're a homebrewer that's got, small conicals, you can harvest a little bit, harvest your yeast off the bottom of the tank, add oxygen to it, and then put that back into your tank. So there's a couple of options, but really what you're trying to do is just gently add a little bit of oxygen to your fermentation and warm it up slightly so that the yeast finishes its job.
Mm. Is there a risk of over adding too much oxygen? Can you oxidize your beer?
Yeah, there's definitely a risk there.
So a little bit goes a long way. Maybe you want to rouse it up and warm it up before you go to the oxygen step.
Right. Yeah. And that, if you do have a conical fermenter and you've got that option available, I definitely recommend giving us a call or giving your local yeast lab a call, and they can walk you through those steps so that you don't add too much oxygen and oxidize your wort or your beer, because no one wants that.
No. And there's a every now and then I get the opposite side of things as well. I'll get a question from somebody saying, I made a starter with this yeast, and I came the next day and it's not doing anything. This yeast is dead. What's wrong? And I'll say, well, take a gravity of your wort. It may be done. And a lot of times, a starter, say, especially a small batch of starter, will be done and before you know it.
that's one of our favorite questions around here. People call in like, I pitched yeast 24 hours ago or 48 hours ago, and I don't see any activity. What's going on? It's like, did you take a gravity reading? No. Do that, and then give us a call back. And often they'll call us back, and they're like, the beer is done, or my starter is done. Like, yeah.
It's what happens when you pitch.
14 days.
So what happens when you pitch a good amount of healthy yeast? It's
right.
Gets to work.
Yeah, it cracks us up. That's our number one, our go-to troubleshooting response.
Yeah.
Did you take gravity reading?
Yeah, exactly. And not only, it's good to take gravity readings. I mean, sometimes rarely I forget. But it is good to take a gravity reading at the beginning of fermentation and a gravity reading at the end of fermentation, because without that data, you can't really know where you are in the process. So it's really good to make that a habit and make sure that that you're keeping your fermentations on track.
Yeah, 100%. Taking good notes is part of being a good brewer, says the person that never, ever, ever takes notes on a batch.
I need to send you a Basic Brewing Brewer's logbook.
You do.
Well, Casey, this is, I know you're super, super busy. I don't know if you want me to mention this, but since we last talked on the show, you're a mom. You've become a mom.
My son was born at the very end of March. So he's almost 10 months old now.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
It's it is. It's I mean, it's amazing how fast time flies. And it's been wonderful. Becoming a parent in a pandemic is a bit of an odd experience, but we're getting through it. And we've luckily had a lot of time to spend at home and just hang out and watch our baby grow. It's been just a wonderful experience.
Well, that's
And
awesome.
he's calling and into everything at this stage. So I think we have a daredevil on our hands.
Well, excellent. I'm super happy for you. And super happy that everything's going well at Imperial, and super happy. I'm just so grateful to y'all for your support, and your continued friendship.
Well, we love what you do, and you're pretty all right yourself too.
All right, Casey. Well, I look forward to the next time.
Yeah, me too. Thank you so much for having us on the show, James. And I look forward to the day that we can have a beer in person, and laugh and talk and enjoy ourselves.
Hear, hear. Thanks again to Casey. Next time I brew, I think I'll do a wort stability test. Although I'm a little afraid of what I might find out. If you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say howdy, write to james@basicbrewing.com or just fill out the contact form on basicbrewing.com. And please don't forget to tell us where you're from. Check out our mobile-friendly shop at basicbrewingshop.com. Thanks to everybody supporting us through our Patreon page. Special goodies coming your way. Check that out at patreon.com/basicbrewing. That's all until next time. Until then, thanks for listening, everybody. I'm James Spencer. Production help for Basic Brewing Radio and our website is provided by Kelly Dodson. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time, everybody. In the meantime, stay well and stay tuned. So long.